a member of my staff will be reported as missing. No one will question a postponement while my team dedicates all its resources to finding him. I believe Simon will outwardly applaud the decision, all the while sowing dissension among the rebel factions and pushing them to schedule an attack. I can convince them to hold off while we search for Michael. If I'm lucky, I might be able to postpone their actions for a week. I only hope it will be long enough. For what? I ask. I thought that would be obvious, she says. There is no choice. We must carry out the rebels' plan to end the testing. For a moment, I'm speechless as her meaning hits home. The rebels were going to start a war. That has never been the intention, she says. The plan is for the rebels to coordinate the elimination of specific targets. The loss of life will be limited to those threats marked for termination. Of course, when violence is employed as a tool, there is always a chance of unexpected casualties. But those involved in creating this plan worked to design a blueprint that would limit losses as much as possible. Strategic targets, termination, tools, blueprint. Clean words for the bloodletting they imply. She opens the folder she's carrying, pulls out a piece of paper, and hands it to me. On it are 11 names. The first is Dr. Jedediah Barnes. Professor Verna Holt is also on the list, as are Professor Douglas Lee and a man named Richard Jeffries, whom I am almost certain is Rafe's father. Just holding the sheet of paper makes my pulse race and my palms start to sweat. President Colander doesn't appear to notice my discomfort as she explains, "The direction of the testing and the university is headed by a select group led by Dr. Barnes. They are members of the university, officials in key government positions, and research scientists whose work has been used by Dr. Barnes to benefit the testing. All of the people listed have enough influence and authority to retain control of the university and testing programs, even if Jedediah is removed from the equation. Simon helped create this document, so there is a chance it is flawed, but I believe the plan is still valid." "You want to murder Dr. Barnes and his top administrators?" "No." I let out a sigh of relief as President Colander reaches over, takes the paper from me, and slides it back into the gray folder. "I'm not going to kill Dr. Barnes and his followers." She places the folder in my hand. "You are." Chapter 3. Her words punch through my chest and steal my breath. The fire crackles. Somewhere in the building, I hear a door slam. President Colander stands still as death, watching me. "You can't be serious," I whisper, though I know she is. "I can't..." "Yes, you can." Her words are sharp, confident. "Though the process of the testing is kept from the public, I've heard enough rumors to understand the tests each candidate must face. For a candidate to pass, she must be intelligent, quick-thinking, and able to prove she is capable of doing whatever it takes to survive." Suddenly, I'm not here. I am on the unrevitalized plains during the fourth test. Tomas whispers my name. In the dim light, I can see the blood as it flows from the wound in his abdomen. Will stands in front of me, his green eyes narrow behind the gun he has now aimed at me. He straightens his shoulders and takes aim. The gun in my hand kicks. Will staggers as the bullet punches into his side. When he runs, I ignore the nausea that is building inside me and fire again. Yes, when attacked, I will do what it takes to survive. But this... I can't. My legs tremble, but my voice is firm, strong, more in control than how I feel. President Colander walks unhurriedly across the room and takes a seat in the chair right next to the fire. I will postpone the vote, but that will only delay the inevitable. If you are correct about Simon's allegiance, how long do you think it will take before he incites the rebels to lead their own attack? What will happen then? Do you think Simon will allow any of the rebels or the citizens who have aided them to live? What will happen to the country if I am gone? Who do you think the debate chamber members will appoint to take my place? Dr. Barnes. If not him, someone he supports. The testing will continue. Sia, I would prefer not to involve you in this, but sometimes a leader has to rely on the resources at hand. My staff has been infiltrated once that we know of. There is no doubt in my mind that where there is one spy, there are more, which means the people in this building cannot be trusted. Neither can the rebels. The safety officials report to one of the names on that list, and there must be others Dr. Barnes knows will take up arms in his support. Otherwise, he wouldn't have embarked on this course of action. She turns and stares at the fire as if looking for answers in the flames, and sighs. I would attempt to execute this plan myself, but it would be impossible for my actions to go unnoticed, and I am no longer confident of whom I can trust. You, Melencia, are the only one I can be certain of, which is why I am forced to ask you to live up to the promise you have made as a future leader and take up this task. As long as Dr. Barnes remains in control of the university, the rebels will not put aside their agenda. Emotions are running high. The rebels are insisting on change. I've talked to a number of them already. I see a flicker of regret on the president's face, but it's gone as quickly as it came. Then all I see is her resolve. I have been told that citizens on the outlying areas of Tosu have been armed by Renetta's rebel faction, despite my express wish for this not to happen. Simon assured me that those allegations are false, and that my orders are being obeyed. But everything he said is suspect. We must assume there are citizens aware of the rebellion and ready to take up arms in support. When the rebels do attack, those citizens could take to the streets. Dr. Barnes's forces will respond. People will be scared. Some will fight. More will die. Michael told me that the rebels were arming citizens. The president is right to fear what could happen with weapons in the hands of so many. The fear, the desperation to survive at all cost. But that might happen no matter what. Shaking off the images, I say, killing Dr. Barnes and his top administrators might gain you control of the testing, but people will panic when they hear that many government officials have died. There has to be another way. When solving geometric proofs, often more than one path of logic can lead to the correct solution. Surely there must be a different route we can take now. The more we talk, the better I understand why Dr. Barnes chose you. Despite my own proximity to the fire, the president's compliment makes me shiver. You are correct, she acknowledges. The death of several Commonwealth officials will be cause for concern. But that is far more easily dealt with than the alternative. Safety officials will be deployed in large numbers. After a week, I can say that the person responsible for the attacks was killed when officials attempted to apprehend him. Personnel schedules and power allotments will return to normal. People will believe the crisis is over because they want to believe their world is safe. I try to imagine how I would feel if I were a Tosu City citizen who heard the president say a murderer that close to top government officials was no longer a threat. Would I believe the danger had passed and that life could return to normal? Yes. Not because I was shown proof, but because I'd want to believe. The president's plan might work. But only if someone were to perform the step that came before. Murder is wrong. I'm amazed at how composed I sound, because inside my head I'm screaming. Think of how different the world would be if someone had eliminated Chancellor Friedrich before she had Prime Minister Che assassinated. The assassination of peacemaker Prime Minister Che fractured the Asian alliance and sparked the first stage of war. Leaders are often forced to make determinations they find distasteful for the good of the people they serve. Asking you to help eliminate the leaders who champion the current mission of the university is the last thing I wish to do. I don't make this request lightly, but it is the best chance we have to avoid a path that will certainly lead to a far worse fate. President Colander stands and crosses to me. She takes the folder from my hand, walks to the table, and picks up a pen. While she flips open the folder and writes something on one of the pages it contains, I swallow hard, close my eyes, and wish that I were back in Five Lakes. That I had never come to Tosu City or learned the secrets behind the testing. War would still be looming, but I would be unaware. The president wouldn't have asked me to betray everything I've ever believed in order to fix what she can't. That is not my job. Coming here and alerting her to the danger was supposed to pass the responsibility of keeping me, my brother, Tomas, and my friends safe to one who has been officially charged with leadership. If I thought I had a chance of successfully orchestrating this plan with my own team, I would. Perhaps I will have to attempt that as a last resort if you do not take up this task. She places the folder back into my hands. Throughout history, leaders have used targeted means to eliminate threats that, if allowed to remain unchecked, could cause far greater damage. When the United Commonwealth was founded, our leaders vowed we would do whatever was necessary to forward the country's mission of revitalization and peace. That mission is now threatened. I'm asking you, Melencia Vale, to help keep our country and its purpose alive. The speech stirs my blood. Since I was little, my goal has been to follow in my father's footsteps, to be selected for the testing, to go to the university, to help my country. But this... Do not give me your answer now. She takes one step closer and puts a hand on my shoulder. I understand the difficult choice I have laid before you. I can hold off the rebels for at least a week, two if I'm lucky. So little time. Inside that folder is the list of those who need to be removed if the testing is to end, along with information on each of them. Also, there is a room on the fifth floor that you might find useful in completing this task. I have written the entrance code on the top page. The president squeezes my shoulder and then steps back. I don't expect this to be easy. You may die in the trying. Even if you don't, there is a strong chance you will fail, although I wouldn't ask this of you if I believed either to be the inevitable conclusion. If by the end of this week you have decided not to pursue this assignment, I ask that you send a message saying that the project is unsustainable. 1 week to decide. Regardless of what you choose, I warn you to be careful. Simon has indicated that members of the rebellion exist among the university students. They could expose you without realizing what they've done. She walks toward the door. Hand on the knob, she looks at me. Trust no one, Sia. It's not just your life, but also the lives of many others that depend on that. As she strides out, I hear her say, I think it is safe to say the young woman has now learned her lesson. I'll be in my office if anyone else needs to meet. The door stays open as her footsteps fade. I know it's time for me to leave, but I'm too stunned by what I've heard, too overwhelmed by the task I've been asked to perform. I want to believe I imagined what just happened, but the folder in my hand belies that wish. My hands are cold when I open it and glance at the first page, which contains the code the president spoke of, as well as the 11 names. No, now there are 12. Written at the bottom in the president's strong block handwriting is the name Simon Dean. Below the name is a series of 7 numbers and the words, I am counting on you. I close the folder and place it on top of my bag. Then I stack the piles of paper from my earlier work onto the table. At the last minute, I take the 3 pages that contain information on 5 Lakes Colony University students. Why? I don't know. Maybe it's just because I can't bear the thought that this information is in the hands of anyone who doesn't know or care about them. Or maybe I need a reminder of where I came from and who I am. My parents raised me to believe in my fellow citizens and in the United Commonwealth, to fix things. I wonder what they would say if they knew I'd been told that in order to fix the country they have worked so hard for, I must now deliberately take lives. The world spins around me. Nausea stirs in my stomach and sears my throat. I shove the folder into my bag and stumble over a crease in the carpet as I hurry to the door. The president has given me a week to choose what I will do, but I don't see how I can make this choice. To allow the testing to continue, or to do what I couldn't when I was tested, and kill. I am not like Will, or Roman, or Damone. I can't commit murder to push myself forward. But can I end lives to ultimately save more? I don't know. And still I find that instead of climbing down the stairs, I go up. I hear voices coming from offices on the 3rd floor, but no one is in the hallway as I quickly climb the next 2 sets of stairs. The 5th floor is quiet. I stop in front of the door with a red-lit keypad at the end of the hall and turn toward the stairs to check if anyone is coming. I see no one. After pulling the paper out of its folder, I punch in the 7-number code, watch the light go from red to green, and slip inside. I wait for the door to close before feeling around the wall for lights. When I find them, my heart begins to hammer. Guns, both large and small. Stack upon stack of boxed ammunition. Knives of varying shapes and sizes. Bulbs filled with an explosive powder that my father and his team used to loosen sections of rock in unrevitalized areas. After a moment, I notice the room contains more than weapons. Long-range transmitters, pocket-sized pulse radios, tracking devices, recorders made in various shapes. Some look much like the ones I remember being used in our testing bracelets. And I realize that this room reminds me of the one Michael brought me to before the 4th test. During the testing, I looked at the weapons provided and saw tools to aid in survival. Now I see them as so many of my fellow testing candidates must have, as a means of taking lives. I slide four of the smallest pulse radios inside my bag. Beside them, I place several recorders and tracking devices, as well as a small monitor that must be used to display the location of the transmitter. I look at the other shelves and consider taking one of the larger knives. But their serrated edges remind me too much of the weapon Tomas carried during the testing, the one that killed Xandri. Telling myself I have no need of the weapons since I don't plan to carry out the president's directive, I walk back to the door and turn off the light. In the darkness, I listen for sounds on the other side. When I hear none, I slip out the door, wait for the light to turn back to red, and head downstairs. One of the officials who brought the files spots me as I reach the third floor. She asks if I need help with my work, and I tell her I finished the assignment and am going home. With a wave, I continue down the next two flights, hoping she isn't one of Simon's rebels. More officials are in the halls on the first floor than when I arrived. I keep my head down and walk to the exit. The fresh air feels cool and wonderful against my skin as I grab my bicycle and begin to ride. I try not to think about the president's request, but it's impossible to forget what she has charged me to do. Dr. Barnes, Professor Holt, Simon, Rafe's father, all people who have had a hand in killing testing candidates either by active participation or passive acceptance. They deserve to be punished for their parts in the deaths of those who came here in hope. But do their actions mean they deserve to die? And if so, can I bring myself to kill them? My stomach heaves as I recall the feel of Damone's blood running over my hand while life drained from his body. If the president has her way, his will be just the first blood I shed. I try to tamp down the nausea, but after three blocks, I jump off my bike and run toward a group of bushes huddled near the side of a sandy-colored brick building. My bike clatters to the walkway behind me as I empty my stomach onto the ground. I wipe my mouth and try to stand up straight, but my stomach tightens again and I hunch over. My legs feel like jelly. Sweat breaks out and I start to shake as the images of those who have died run through my mind. Rhyme's empty eyes. Ramon's bloody body. Michael's face as it drained of color just before he crumpled to the ground. Slowly the shaking subsides and I straighten. I take careful steps. The weakness I felt seems to have passed. But when I pick up my bike, I choose to walk with it down the city street instead of riding. I fumble with the fastenings on my bag and dig out a bottle of water. The water cleanses my mouth and throat of the taste of bile, but it can't wash away the cause. I wheel my bike north while taking sips of water, not paying attention to where I'm headed. When I come to a small fountain in the middle of a grassy area surrounded by a small square of shops, I set my bike on the ground and take a seat on the stone lip of the fountain. It is cool, but the early evening light has encouraged many to come out of doors. Children play a game of tag. Several couples sit on benches along the walkways that surround the park. Everything seems so normal. No one here feels the tension of the power struggle that is about to threaten their world. I pull the transit communicator out of my bag, hit the call button, and close my eyes as I wait for Zine to respond. But no matter how much I want to hear his voice, the communicator remains silent, and I have no idea what I should do now. I went to the president so she could save him and everyone else from Dr. Barnes, Simon, and the destruction the false rebellion will cause. She was supposed to take charge and solve this problem. Instead, she's turned it back on me, and I'm not sure I'm capable of walking the path she has pointed me toward. Swallowing hard, I open my eyes and stare at the clean, clear water gurgling next to me. The fountain is not simply decorative, but is used by citizens to fill their drinking bottles, and I find myself thinking of the people who survived the 7 stages of war. The fear they must have felt when the South American coalition attacked. When President Dalton responded by ending the stance of isolationism he'd adopted in hopes that avoiding conflict would bring peace. It didn't. Nor did the violence that came after. Cities around the world were leveled. Millions killed. Finally, leaders decided to lay down their weapons before they destroyed not only their enemies, but themselves. The 4th stage of war ended, and peace treaties were signed. Despite the devastation, there must have been a sense of hope, a feeling that the worst was over. But the Earth didn't sign a treaty. The biological and chemical warfare employed during the first 4 stages could not be wiped away with the stroke of a pen. Peace would not be so easy. Earthquakes, chemical-laden rainstorms, floods, tornadoes, hurricanes. By the time the 7th stage of war ended, the weather and landscape had been unimaginably changed. It's amazing that humans survived. How easy it would have been to look at the horror around them and give up. Food was scarce. Uncontaminated water was almost impossible to find. But they didn't surrender. They salvaged what they could from their homes and set out to find other survivors. They came here. They revitalized this city, brick by brick, tree by tree. They began to restore what their leaders had destroyed. There must have been terrible choices to be made. People who refused to endorse a centralized government created trouble. They hoarded resources, caused fights on the debate chamber floor, and turned the focus away from the good of everyone to themselves. City officials encouraged them to leave Tosu. Eventually, they did. When my 5 Lakes classmates and I were studying this part of history, our teacher told us that the dissenters disappeared from the city. I assumed she meant that they set out to find a new place where they could live as they chose. Now I wonder, would those intent on bringing down the newly created government have been able to leave so easily? Especially when their dissent was causing the governing body so much trouble? There were food riots. Solar panels were destroyed or stolen. Vigilantes patrolled the streets, fighting with and sometimes killing those the government had assigned to ensure their safety. With a shortage of resources and a flurry of lawlessness, there must have been concern that the new government was flawed, that it was not in control, that maybe not following the new rules for resource distribution and revitalization would make things better. How difficult those days must have been. With new food resources available and plants and trees thriving in the revitalized soil, it seems impossible to imagine that anyone could have believed trying to survive on their own would be better than working together and following the same rules. But quite a few did. Yet somehow the government regained control. In order to do so, did they eliminate those who were intent on wreaking havoc? Maybe. If so, were they wrong? I look at the sparkling, uncorrupted water, and then at the children laughing as they play. Would these things be here now if the dissenters had destroyed what was just being created? Does this end justify a means paved with blood? I don't know. At one time I would have been certain. This situation would have appeared black and white. I wish it did now. I told President Colander that I could not eliminate those whose names are written on the paper in my bag. I want to believe that this is the truth. But the pressure I feel growing in my chest as I look around at a city that was forged in struggle and in hope makes me wonder whether there might be another truth. That like the seven stages of war and the time that followed, peace will come accompanied by sacrifice and death. I glance at the watch on the strap of my bag. The sun will soon be setting. I need to return to campus. I know I should get on my bike and return, but I find myself pulling the gray folder out of my bag again and opening it. There are the 12 names, the code to the fifth floor room, and the note President Colander wrote to me. Under that page are several more sheets of gray recycled paper, 11 of them, to be exact. One for each of the original 11 names on the president's list. At the top of each page is a name followed by the person's residence, family information, and role in the testing. Not surprisingly, the first page of this group centers on Dr. Jedediah Barnes. The location of his home means little to me, since I am not from Tosu City, although I do remember other students mentioning that his personal dwelling is on one of the streets that surround the university campus. I read the name of his wife and picture the woman I met last summer, after the testing was over. His two children are 16 and 12, approaching the age when they can apply to the university. With their father as head of the program, they no doubt would be selected. But will they want to be a part of the trials that follow? Dr. Barnes has been in charge of the testing for 15 years. During that time, 1,132 students have sat for the testing. Of those, 128 were passed through to the university. Over 1,000 students who wished to help the world are gone because of him. As the light fades, I read through the other pages, committing as much as possible to memory. Professor Holt, an advocate for adding another section to the testing to push the ability of students to think critically while under emotional strain. Professor Markham, head of medical studies, who created the newest version of the memory erasure serum and is working on a neurological implant to help officials better monitor the way each prospective student deals with the strain of the testing process. Professor Lee, who, according to this information, not only helped create the scoring system for each group of students during the first round of the testing, but is advocating for a larger pool of candidates to ensure that none of the best and brightest escape notice. Page after page of leaders, all working to make the testing harder, more invasive, deadlier. White-hot anger builds inside me as I start over and reread the descriptions by the fading light. These people were entrusted with the lives of the next generation of leaders. They have betrayed not only that trust, but also the faith of the entire country. Emotions cloud my vision, making it hard to read through the last few pages. Rage, sorrow, fear, despair. They chip away my resolve to refuse the president's request and pull at the beliefs I have been taught to hold dear. When I finally finish my second read, I slide the papers back into the folder, fill my water bottle at the fountain, and climb onto my bike. Using the transit communicator to guide me, I head back to the university, taking the same path I used to get to the president's office. The route isn't the most direct, but getting back quickly isn't my purpose. While I would prefer to destroy the papers the president gave me, there is a chance I will have need of the information they contain. Hiding them so I can't be caught with them is my best option. I spot a neighborhood where the roads and sidewalks are cracked and broken, and the grass less green, and turn to enter it. The roofs of the houses sag in the middle. Boards across windows and doors signal a lack of materials to make repairs. Stairs are missing steps. Swirls of faded paint decorate the houses' exteriors. The front yards are mostly dirt with a few patches of scraggly yellowish grass. If it weren't for the hopeful budding of the healthy trees on the street, I would think this area had yet to be revitalized and that people didn't yet live here. But they do. A ragdoll sitting near the rotted front steps of a squat brown house with a porch that is carefully swept of debris and a metal shovel that is free of rust sitting outside another dwelling tell me that people are here. Since coming to Tosu, I've realized that despite the best intentions of the government, it's almost impossible for a city this size to treat all citizens the same. Streets that government officials call home are repaired more frequently than those of people who don't hold influential jobs. But the rundown appearance of some areas notwithstanding, I've never seen another so poorly tended as this one. While that disturbs me, in a way I'm glad. It's clear that the government rarely, if ever, notices this street, so it could be a perfect place to hide the papers I don't want anyone to find. In the last rays of daylight, I study the dilapidated, graffiti-laden houses on either side of the roadway, ignoring those that show signs of habitation. A small one-story structure with boarded-up windows and a sagging roof catches my eye. The houses across from it show subtle signs of occupancy, but this one, and the two on either side, look as though nothing but rodents and small animals have gone near the front door in months. Careful to keep to the grass so I don't leave footprints in the dirt, I cross to the back of the house. The door in the rear hangs precariously from its hinges. I can see at least one spot where an animal has constructed a nest in the eave of the roof. I lean my bicycle against the back of the house and walk to the door. The hinges let out a shrill protest as I shift it open. I go still and wait to see if anyone appears. When no one does, I walk inside into a small kitchen. Doors of cabinets are missing. In the center of the room, the remains of a collapsed table lie sprawled on the floor, surrounded by three wooden chairs. Leaves and twigs are scattered on the ground. Still, I search the rest of the structure to make sure this place is not in use. The living room floor is coated in a thick layer of dust. The lone sofa in the room is so worn that springs poke through its cushions. I search the bathroom and two bedrooms. When I see no obvious signs of habitation, I pull my pocket knife out of my bag, then open the bedroom closet. Kneeling, I use the knife to prod around the floorboards. Several are loose. I pry up three, stand up to pull the folder out of my bag, remove the list of names, and tuck the rest of the papers into the spot I dug out. I replace the floorboards and pile the clothes stained with Damone's blood on top of them. Then I close the closet door and hurry out. I save the coordinates of this location on the transit communicator, then climb onto my bicycle and ride. When I reach the end of the street, I look back at the house where the papers lie hidden, knowing that if I return to retrieve them, it will be because I've chosen to take up President Colander's charge. And not just me, because this task is not one that I can complete on my own. My father told me to trust no one. I've broken that edict more than once, often to my detriment. And if the president is right, and there is no other way to end the testing and the destruction to the country that might come, I may have to break it again. Chapter 4. The sky is dark as I cross under the arch that marks the entrance to the campus. Solar lights illuminate the roadways and the buildings that I pass. I see fewer students than usual. Many spend their Saturday evenings in their rooms, catching up on sleep or blowing off steam. But normally there are more than the handful of students I see going to and from the library or sitting on the benches outside the residences. The inactivity makes my heart race as I pedal across the bridge toward the vehicle shed. I store my bike and hurry around to the entrance of the residence.
See ya.
I jump at the sound of my name and squint into the shadows, looking for the source. For a moment, I see nothing. Then a figure moves away from the trunk of the weeping willow tree into the faint moonlight.
Enzo.
Of all the university students, Enzo is the one I think I most understand, and the one I am more inclined to believe has my best interests at heart. He isn't like the others, whose families have ties to the Commonwealth government. He couldn't rely on his parents' connections in order to get accepted to the university. Enzo worked for it. He, like me, wanted to come to the university to help better our country. That similarity and the lack of connection to those who currently lead the university are the reasons I cross the grass instead of going inside. If Enzo has been waiting outside the residence for me, the reason must be important. As I walk toward him, Enzo looks around to make sure we are alone. When I reach his side, he says,
"Professor Holt is looking for you."
I swallow hard.
"Do you know why?"
Does she want to know what I was doing in the city today? Does she suspect what the president has asked of me? Or is this about what happened last night?
"Professor Holt has been interviewing everyone in the residence to see if anyone has information as to Damone's whereabouts."
"Maybe he went to visit his family," I say, hoping Enzo doesn't hear the strain in my voice. Many Tosu City students use their free hours on the weekends to spend time at home. The action isn't encouraged by university staff, but neither is it condemned. Their being able to visit those they love is just one more aspect that separates those of us from the colonies from the students born in Tosu City. Even Enzo has taken time away from his studies to make the trek to the south side of the city to see his family.
"I told her that I spotted Damone this morning from my window. He had a bag over his shoulder as he came out of the vehicle building with his bicycle. Professor Holt is checking to see if Damone went home."
Enzo looks toward the bridge as if searching for answers. After several long moments, he quietly says,
"I couldn't sleep last night."
5 words. Enough to make my pulse pound. My heart ticks off the seconds as I wait for what comes next. 10? 20? Finally, he says,
"My bedroom window next to my desk faces the back of the residence. Normally, I don't bother to look outside, but I did. I saw Damone."
His head turns toward me.
"And you."
I what? I wasn't there? I was. And Enzo and I wouldn't be having this conversation if he had any doubt that it was me he saw in the moonlight.
"What did you see?"
My voice sounds harsh, panicked. I'm both. If Enzo has lied about what he said to Professor Holt, I will have 2 choices: run or be redirected. Maybe that's why he's telling me now, to give me a chance to flee.
"I saw Damone and you fighting. I was going to come help, but by then my help wasn't necessary. Damone is dead, and I'm not sorry. He shouldn't have attacked you. He shouldn't have even been here in the first place. It's people like him that made my father agree to help change things. He and my brothers..."
Enzo looks back to the horizon. Taking a deep breath, he says,
"Look, I'm not telling you this to make you afraid. I just want you to know that I could see you and Wraith. If I could, someone else might have. Professor Holt is talking to everyone inside the residence. You need to be prepared."
"Why are you telling me this?" I ask. "You could go to Professor Holt, tell her what you saw, and collect your reward."
"I'm not Damone." Enzo's voice trembles. He and Griffin want to be important. I want to make a difference. I promised my family I would. They're counting on me. Selling you out to Professor Holt wouldn't make them proud or help them. They are fighting against what she stands for. I am too. Enzo takes several steps toward the residence and turns back to face me. I don't know why you were out of the residence last night or why you let Rafe help you. He's one of them. I think you and I are on the same side, so be careful, okay? For a moment, we just look at each other. Enzo watching me for signs of agreement. Me waiting for, I don't know. Something that tells me he really is on my side. That he isn't repelled to know I am responsible for taking a life. That he can be trusted to aid me if I see no other way to end the testing than to follow the president's command. Whatever he sees on my face must be enough of an answer because, without another word, he turns and leaves me standing under the willow, struggling to think through what he has told me. Is it safe for me to stay, or should I pack my bag and run now while I still can? Part of me wants to flee. If I could talk to Zine, I know he would tell me to run. But he still isn't answering. I want to believe that he hasn't been able to find a place isolated enough to contact me. To think otherwise would shatter me. My brother is smart and resourceful. I just have to be patient. But I can't wait to hear from him before formulating a plan. If I were to run, Tomas would go with me. The two of us are resourceful. We would have a greater chance of survival than most. Our survival of the testing proves that. Running would mean I wouldn't have to face the choice I've been given. For a moment, I look at the bridge. I imagine what it would be like to leave behind this place and everything I know. Then I turn and walk to the residence. Because there's too much at stake. I might not be able to stop what is to come, but I can't leave without trying or without learning what has become of my brother. The sight of two officials in ceremonial purple greets me as I walk through the entryway of the residence. Enzo is nowhere to be seen. The minute the officials see me, the one on the left takes a step forward and says, "Malencia Vale?" I try to keep the concern I feel off my face as I nod. "Professor Holt asks that you report to her in the main common room once you arrived. She'll be glad to know you are safe." While I'm not sure Professor Holt will feel delight upon seeing me, I thank the official for his message. I then head in the direction of the common room, hoping I didn't make the wrong decision when I chose to stay instead of run. I walk down the hall to the large room that we use for residence gatherings, studying and relaxing in between classes. Professor Holt is seated near the large stone fireplace. Her squared shoulders, her short cap of red hair, and the crimson color of her clothing give her an undeniable air of authority. Across the room, several upper-year students are standing in small groups. It only takes one of them noticing my approach for Professor Holt to turn toward me. Her almond-shaped eyes narrow behind her thickly framed glasses before she turns back to the students gathered nearby. A look from Professor Holt sends them hurrying out the door, leaving the two of us alone. Forcing a smile, I say, "You asked to see me, Professor Holt?" I stand motionless while Professor Holt studies me. My heart hammers as I think of Enzo's words, the lie he swore he told, and the gray paper in my bag. In my mind, I picture Professor Holt's name written in firm black letters beneath that of Dr. Barnes. Would she understand the purpose of the list if, for some reason, she asked to see the contents of my bag? And what would she say if she saw the gun and the transmitters? "Please take a seat." Professor Holt waves me into the faded armchair across from her. I sit, wishing I could have found a plausible reason to stand, since I had the advantage of height and the ability to run. Sitting with my bag on my lap, I am very aware of being at the mercy of Professor Holt and the university if the answers I give are not correct. Professor Holt leans back in her chair and asks, "Have you been experiencing any problems in your classes or with your internship?" The subject matter catches me off guard. I blink twice and consider her seemingly innocuous words. After being assigned to the government studies program, my fellow students and I were given class schedules. I was assigned 9 classes, the most of any first-year student. Failure to keep up with the course load is monitored closely. Some students who struggled have already been redirected out of the university. According to my guide, Ian, I have been watched more carefully than my peers for signs of difficulty. There is something about me that Dr. Barnes and Professor Holt found troubling long before my untracked disappearance from campus this morning. Something that goes back to the testing. Even with my returned memories, I haven't been able to puzzle out what that something is. And not now, with Professor Holt staring at me, waiting for an answer. My admitting my workload is difficult could give her an opening to doubt my abilities as a student. But saying I'm managing my schedule with ease is a lie, one she will certainly call me on. Without understanding her agenda, I carefully say, "It's a challenge to keep up with all of the work, but I'm determined to succeed." "I'm sure you are." Professor Holt's smile fades. "Damone Pyburn was determined as well, but he appears to have vanished from campus. He hasn't been seen since last night. When your friends couldn't find you, I was concerned you might have disappeared as well." Her eyes flick to the bracelet on my wrist, a sure sign that my whereabouts were never in doubt. I wonder if Damone's bracelet is currently able to be tracked, and if Professor Holt knows he is at the bottom of the chasm that surrounds this building. Or does the tear in the earth go too deep for her and Dr. Barnes to trace with a short-range transmitter? Giving her an embarrassed smile, I say, "I apologize if I caused anyone to worry. I had some questions about a project I'm working on, and decided to go to the president's office to get some answers." If President Holt looks for the lie in my words, she won't find them. Nodding, she says, "I appreciate your dedication to your studies, as I'm sure the president does. And of course, you left before I requested that students remain in the residence so that I could discuss Damone's unusual disappearance with all of you individually. So you had no way of knowing that you went against my explicit instructions." "I would never have left had I known I was instructed to stay on campus." Her lips purse. "Well, now that you're back, perhaps you can tell me whether you had cause to speak with or spend time with Damone Pyburn before he went missing." I consider my words carefully as I say, "Despite our being on the same team during induction, I don't know Damone very well. He made it clear that he wasn't interested in being friends with colony students, so we rarely, if ever, spoke." "And yet you saved his life. Twice." "Only to end it later." I stifle the urge to shift in my seat and say, "It was the right thing to do for my team." "And you always do the right thing." "No," I answer honestly. "Growing up, I was taught that it's impossible to know what the right thing always is. The best you can do is to try to do what you think is right for yourself and the people around you." Professor Holt stares at me for a minute as if trying to read hidden meanings in my words. Finally, she says, "I have been told that you were absent from the residence twice today." Blood pounds in my ears. Cautiously, I nod. "I went into the city." "The first time was with Rafe Jeffries. Yes, I spoke with him earlier. He gave me an account of your outing. Perhaps you'd like to give me yours.
What to say? I don't know the explanation Rafe gave Professor Holt for our leaving campus. If my answer doesn't match the one he gave, Professor Holt will question everything I've said thus far. And I've used my internship to cover my journey to the city this afternoon. I can't use the same excuse for Rafe and me going out this morning. Hoping Rafe didn't tell an elaborate story, I say, Rafe knows I haven't had much of a chance to explore Tosu City. We ran into each other before breakfast and he volunteered to show me around. Professor Holt tilts her head to the side. What time did you and Mr. Jeffries meet?
Breakfast starts at 7:30.
Around 7, I think. Most students don't get up on the weekend until after the allotted time for breakfast has already begun, so the time I quoted gives less of a chance for her to question why other students didn't see us. I can only hope the logic Rafe used to give his answer was the same I employed to create mine.
Are you certain that time is accurate?
I'm certain it's not, but I can't change my answer now. Instead, I force a laugh and say, it might have been just before or just after. I wasn't watching the time all that closely.
Mr. Jeffries said the two of you planned to meet this morning, but you implied it was a spontaneous trip.
I feel color fill my cheeks and I clutch my bag as my mind races, trying to decide how best to explain the discrepancy. Out of the corner of my eye, I see someone hovering in the doorway of the common room. Turning, I lock eyes with him. His long dark hair frames his pale face and deep green eyes.
You need something, Mr. O'Donovan?
Professor Holt asks. Her tone is clipped, indicating her displeasure at being interrupted. Will doesn't seem to be bothered by Professor Holt's annoyance. Flashing a crooked smile, he shoves his hands into his pockets and leans against the door jamb.
No, I was just checking to make sure Sia was okay. I ran into Tomas Endres earlier, and he was worried that he hadn't seen her all day. Don't worry, Sia.
Will's smile grows wider. I didn't tell him that you spent most of the day with another guy. He winks. Frowning, I look down at my hands as though embarrassed by Will's words. In reality, I feel relief as Professor Holt dismisses Will with a reminder that all students are to remain inside the residence until after breakfast tomorrow. When she turns her attention back to me, I quietly say, Tomas and I aren't as close as we used to be, but I don't want to upset him if I don't have to. We're both from Five Lakes, and I shrug and take a deep breath. I thought it would be better if he heard that my visit to the city with Rafe was spur of the moment instead of something we planned. My nerves jump as Professor Holt stares at me, her eyes unblinking behind her glasses.
It is always difficult to decide whether emotional attachment is due to shared experiences or to something deeper. If you aren't careful, those kinds of attachments can cause distractions you don't need. That's only one of the many reasons I'm pleased Dr. Barnes continued the practice of eliminating testing memories in successful candidates. The last thing we need is students who have formed personal attachments as a mechanism for dealing with stress.
At Professor Holt's mention of the testing, I find myself recalling the information I read earlier today and her placement on the list of people marked for death. While I don't like Professor Holt, the idea of deliberately ending her life makes my heart cringe.
Professor Holt, can I ask a question?
She blinks behind her glasses.
Of course.
I choose each word with caution as I say, do you think the testing is the best way to select future leaders?
Why do you ask?
I heard people at the president's office discussing the testing. Since I don't remember my experience, I thought I'd ask your opinion. Do you think putting candidates through the testing is necessary?
We need strong leaders more than ever before. One wrong choice could cause everything we have rebuilt to collapse.
Dark eyes filled with conviction meet mine.
The testing is not only necessary, in my opinion. The process is not nearly hard enough.
The confidence in her stride as she walks out the door leaves no doubt. If Professor Holt has her way, even more testing candidates will die.
Chapter 5. The residence hall is quiet as I go to the dining area to get something to eat. I fill a plate and balance it as I walk up the 2 flights of stairs. Unlike most nights, no one is wandering the halls, which makes me wonder about Will's arrival during my interview with Professor Holt. Why was he out of his rooms? Was he looking for me? His appearance helped me come up with a plausible answer to her question. Was that on purpose or just a coincidence? I haven't come up with answers to these questions about Will as I turn the key in my lock and enter my rooms. Pushing aside all thoughts of Will and whatever agenda he might have, I unfasten my bag and look at the things I took from the room on the 5th floor. Why I selected these items is still a mystery to me. Perhaps instinct had me grabbing anything that would give me comfort. Fixing, creating, and modifying technology has always been what I have done best. Since being assigned to government studies, I've felt removed from that part of me, just as geography and our different fields of study have made me feel cut off from Tomas. Suddenly I realize that the pulse radios in my possession mean neither is an obstacle. After the 7 stages of war, scientists utilized the higher concentration of electromagnetic radiation in the air to restore communication with these devices. Pulse radios were designed to record chunks of information and, using pulse-like signals, send them to receiving devices that are set to a course